session number 4748, reel number 1.
Mr. Payne, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Mr. Payne, how you came to join the army?
Well, when I was a schoolboy at the City of London School, I was a member of their OTC, which is Officer Training Corps, and I used to have to come up from Blackheath, where I was living, twice a week in uniform to school and do the school lessons in uniform and then do parades for the OTC. So that I did have a slight flavour for discipline. And then when I left school, I went and joined a firm of insurance brokers in the City of London. And there we were encouraged to join the Territorial Army. And so I became a member of the HAC and the 11th Regiment Royal Horse Artillery. And there, once or twice in the evening, a week, we used to go for training at an armoury house, City Road, and camps and things like that, weekend camps. And then, of course, that was in May 1939 that I joined the HAC, so I didn't have long before a certain other date in September when war was there. And at the time when I listened to the speech, actually in an air raid shelter in the grounds of the armoury house in City Road. From there, we were told we would be immediately mobilised and we should be at the ready to go to war, as you might say. So for about a week, I used to carry a case with all my belongings up to the office and with a telephone number handy to call me, and I had about 10 other numbers to call in turn. We had a sort of round robin so that we'd get everybody there as quickly as we can rather than one person ringing up everybody. And eventually we were called up and we paraded at Armoury House, and we were inspected by now the Queen Mother. She was then the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. And that's how we marched off to war. We actually left Armoury House, went down to the Central Line Underground Station, it was a district line, to be more precise, and we went by train to Elstree, that's where we started off our war, in Elstree Village, sort of business, doing just getting ourselves and all the people who've been used to civilian life, getting them used to a certain amount of military discipline.
Well, we can't go into the early service, but can you tell me next how you came to be go to Malaya?
Yes. After a while, I was selected to go to Anokju, an officer training unit, and I went to Ilkley. I went to Ilkley in January 1941. And after 6 months, in June, I was passed out from that Ilkley as a second lieutenant in the Royal Artillery. I was then posted to a regiment that was doing depot duty at the School of Artillery in Lark Hill. They were just an independent regiment there. It was termed as an army field regiment. And we were there at the beck and call of the School of Artillery to do any experiments and also to provide the guns for the young cadets coming out of Ocu, and for them to do their training and also their passing out gunnery drill. Then we were, I think it must have been September, we were told we were going to be mobilised. And as an ordinary gunner, I was attached to I was in the stores, working in the quartermaster stores, and when a unit is mobilised, the quartermaster, the captain quartermaster, is entitled to some assistance. Well, I was allocated to the quartermaster to go and get all the equipment for the regiment right up to a certain code number category. Now, that certain code number, which was all very secretive, of course, you just looked at the book and saw the various places that you might be going to. And if you were being issued with tropical kit, pith helmets, and et cetera, one would imagine, well, one did imagine, I suppose, not naively, that you were going to a hot climate. But I think some other things did change in that. As it so happens, we sailed. We sailed from, with all the equipment on another boat, we sailed from Liverpool. We, owing to the submarine problems in the Atlantic, we went right across the Atlantic in the direction of Iceland, then in the direction of Canada, then down a little bit south, not landing anywhere, then down a little bit south, we cut right across in convoy to Freetown, where we called into Freetown Harbour, and as a sideline, it was in Freetown Harbour where we were able to have the ship's lights on and everything. I went out in the regiment, we had a, we thought we were going to a Peacetown station in Singapore, actually, but we had all our civilian clothes, a regimental band, and which had a dance band, and also on board ship were 48 Queen Alexander's Imperial Nursing Services. And as it so happens, when I arrived in Freetown Harbour, it was my 21st birthday. So I can tell you I had a very, very good 21st birthday on board a vessel, the Dominion Monarch, which was a Shaw Savile ship, and it hadn't been converted to a trooper. So I think I had started off on a very good war that way, but we were soon to be disillusioned. We did arrive, having called in at Colombo. On the way, we arrived at Singapore. We arrived in Singapore, and then the main body of the regiment went up to the middle or centre of Malaya, to a place called Kajang, just south of Kuala Lumpur, where they were going to get acclimatized up there. A party remained back on the island to unload all the vehicles, the guns, etc., etc., and stores, and they were going up by road. Well, this did happen, and we made our way up Malaya with our guns and all the equipment. When we got to Kajang, we were told, in fact, the day we left Singapore Island was the first day that the 27 bombers, Japanese bombers, came over and raided Singapore. So by the time we got up to Kajang, the scare had gone up and the regiment was told to be prepared to go right up to the frontier, the Siam Malaya frontier. And because the 11th Indian Division didn't have any 25-pounders, and we were the first 25-pounder regiment into Malaya, and we weren't attached to any division or anything. We were just a freelance unit. And so up we went the border without any chance of getting used to climate or anything, and only just having unpacked all our stores. And the vehicles had been on board ship. They hadn't got properly loosened up, as you might say, and they'd all been greased, and the guns were greased, and so there was a lot of work had to go into that. And then before we knew where we were in action.
Can you tell me what that involved?
Well, it's rather an embarrassing thing. It must be beautiful to be in an advancing army, but what it did involve is we did go into action, and then from that very minute we unfortunately, went backwards all the time. We were beaten down by an army, not superior in numbers, not superior in vehicle strength. We were beaten by an army which was orientated to jungle warfare, and also by an army that wasn't mamby-pambied, as you might say, for food. They were given a bag of rice and they had to go and pinch their own bicycles if they wanted transport. If not, they were in the jungle and they just fought their way down. And I think that is really one of the difficulties we had in Malaya. There was only one real arterial road down the centre of Malaya, and of course with a lot of vehicles on it, that was a sitting target to the Japanese vast air superiority. When I say vast, they didn't have to have many aircraft, because the aircraft strength in Malaya was absolutely, well, diabolical. One or two Bristol Buffaloes, I think, and a couple of wild beasts or something like that. It really was actually pathetic.
You said that the Japanese weren't namby-pambied. Do you think that you were?
I would say, for jungle warfare, you have to be mobile. And bearing in mind, in all fairness, that we hadn't been used to jungle warfare or anything. We didn't know what it was and when you're in. And also, living in and out of gun positions and in the rubber plantations. To live in rubber plantations, it is known to be very depressing. You're sort of hemmed in all the time down there. For mamby-pambied, to explain that word, I was meaning that the food supplies have to be brought up, and we had so many very well equipped with vehicles and things like that, and I think that is my personal opinion.
Do you mean that you felt that you were encumbered by too much material or something?
To be quite honest, I do.
What type of material do you think?
Well,
that they
too many.
Should have
too many. They should have had. We didn't have tanks. We should have had practical material, not all these masses of supplies and stuff which you can just put easily on your back and get off with it. And I do. What I've seen since my return home, I think a lesson has been learnt in the wonderful fighting that went on by the very brave men who took part in releasing us. They obviously were orientated and been trained, but we were, unfortunately, just guinea pigs or gun fodder thrown into the mill.
Did you actually see the Japanese during this action?
Actually see the Japanese. Now, you'll never believe this, but it was very difficult to know what a Jap looked like, quite frankly, because you had Malays, Chinese, Japanese, and quite we've just come out from England without any, and nobody really told. We couldn't say where we were going. They couldn't because of security measures, so we won't be able to be filmed and told what the characteristics of these people were. In the you could see definitely people moving in the jungle, and where they got very close to us because we. Once again, the infantry regiments that were there, a lot of them did very well, and a lot of them were some from various other countries who were just untrained, and we found often that the guns were in the front line and the infantry were behind us, which is rather an embarrassing situation when the Japanese used mortars a lot for jungle warfare, and they range, and by goodness me, it is a nasty feeling when you've got your gun position and one comes right to the left of you, one mortar shell, one comes right to the right of you, one at the back of you, and one in the front of you, and then where's the next one coming? And they were often very accurate with their mortars. You might say, how did they know where we were? Well, you had a lot of spy work went on before the war. There was much of the infiltration of the Japanese into Malaya, Singapore and Malaya, where they were doing jobs as photographers, wedding photographers and things, and they always seemed to take wedding photographs with a background instead of a church, gun position or such things like that. And they bribed a lot of the natives of this multinational country, as you might say, and often, and I have, I'm not ashamed to say so, killed, I can't say what nationals they were, but where they're cutting arrows in paddy fields. Now, cutting arrows in paddy fields, pointing to gun positions so that the aircraft could spot them positions and tell the infantry where we were.
You mean this was during this action?
Yes, yes, yes.
You saw people doing this, and so you shot at them.
So we shot at them, yeah. That's war.
So can you continue with what happened?
Then we continued on down Malaya through the various large towns and airfields, and sometimes some of the airfields we went through, the poor old Air Force, who had very bad equipment and everything, were evacuated very quickly, and very, very quickly, by the way, that they didn't have time to take any of their personal possessions or even finish their breakfast, which you could find somewhere. So then we went down, and then we got to an area where the Japanese came down with their tanks, and it's an area which has been written about quite a lot, Slim River. And it was at Slim River where my gun troop were overrun by the tanks. The tanks came hurtling down the road and cut us off. We were then cut off by the Japs who were behind us, and we were stuck north of them, as you might say, from our own troops. And what did we have to do then? Because more and more Japanese were coming down, so I feel very ashamed to have to admit it, but I did it. We had to spike our guns, which is really a sad thing for a gunnery officer to say that it happened, but we were determined that we would not give the guns over to the Japanese. We not only did we spike our guns, we broke all of the loose equipment, the gun sights, and anything we could possibly do to save our enemy, making use of our stock. Likewise, as we were coming down through Malaya, any of the rubber plantation buildings, where the curing houses, we damaged those as much as we could so it wouldn't affect their war effort. They couldn't use the rubber and the latex for their bettering their war scene. We then had to do a thing. We broke up into two parties. One went one way and one went the other. One party, unfortunately, were captured, and the other party weren't. I was in the latter one, luckily, and we got down. We got behind. We went cut off through the jungle with our compass and map, and we trekked with these about 150 men down through the jungle and to get round behind the Japanese lines back into our own lines. That involved crossing some rivers, and when you've got the Japanese close on your tail and you come across a river with crocodiles looking in at you, it's a matter of what's worse. So we thought we better, our duty was to get back to our own troops, so we did our best to form a human chain across this. Well, in fact, we didn't do our best. We did form a human chain across this stream, not able to fire at the animal, alligators or crocodiles and things to frighten them, but we threw missiles at them and did our best to keep. And luckily enough, we got across.
Did the crocodiles keep away?
Yes, thank God. They did, and I was the tail end Charlie, being a young subaltern, I suppose, doing my duty to the men, which I've been trained to do, sort of business, and I was very pleased to get to the other side of that river.
Were the Japanese pursuing you?
Yes. They were coming down. They were always close on our tail. Well, then we got down to just north of Kuala Lumpur, where, having spent a few days in the jungle and been fighting all the way back from Malaya, from the north of Malaya, I should say, with very little sleep, tired, and I won't say we didn't look very smart, I must admit, but it's a bit hard to be told by a visiting general who'd been popped in for a few minutes to say that you look a disgusting mess, etc., smarten yourselves up and get on with the job. Whereupon he got in an aircraft and flew off to safety. I won't mention his name for diplomatic reasons, I feel. Anyhow, we then, some of us, were attached to other gunner units that had been depleted by their actions, which they've had, and the losses in action. But I was, and my party of men, were taken down by train back to Singapore Island. But on the way down to Singapore Island on the train, for some unknown reason, some level crossing gates and signals had been put to stop. And at a place called Tibon, just at the very minute that everything was happening and we were at a standstill, overcome, some Japanese fighters bombed us and machine gunned us as we were getting out of the train. Quite frankly, I didn't realise it was machine gun fire. I thought the way that people were running around, they'd jumped out of the train into a wasp nest or a bee's nest. But it was these bullets that were flying all around. On this train, not only were the military, but there were civilians. And many, many, many Chinese were killed, and one or two of we were killed, our chaps were killed, including a fellow officer of mine who was in the next carriage to me. It's just one of those sad things. We then, with the Chinese, wanted to bury their dead on the spot, sort of business. Well, they came to me as a British officer asking me if I would carry out the burial service. So I didn't know quite what to do in the circumstances, so I thought the best way was to try and ease their mental strain and their worry and that by doing just the thing. And I got my diary out of my pocket and opened it and just said what I thought was a nice few words, they thinking it was but I felt I was doing my duty to them, and we were thanked very much for the courtesies which we carried out in that public relations exercise. And I like to feel that perhaps we did win the hearts of some Chinese who perhaps were able to help our chaps later on by doing it that way, rather than let them go over to the sister Japanese. We then got in the train again and finished up down in Singapore Island, where we were re-equipped with some different sort of guns. They were French 75mm guns with a split trail, that's the type of gun. And we were put to various places on the island to do coastal defence with these guns. And we went to near Changi Point, a place called Loyang, facing the island of Paula Ubin, where we waited for the Japanese arrival. And they did appear on this island, and we opened fire considerably, but then we were ordered to move back into the island perimeter. I am jumping quite a lot here because of wartime, and a lot of things happened which we didn't know where we was going on, and that the reservoirs were being captured as the Japs came across the causeway, and the water supply to the civilians in the island, because you've got to bear in mind that by this time Singapore Island was crammed full with civilians. And some civilians who were friendly, some civilians who were far from friendly, and some civilians who were the enemy. So you didn't know who you were with, sort of business. And we did make our way back to Singapore itself, and where I was with the two guns which I was left with were joined up with another 25-pounder unit just in front of Raffles Hotel, with our backs right to the water. We couldn't go back any further, and there we fired our guns on fixed sights until the breech blocks seized up. And so we finished up with useless guns, with deaf ears, absolutely exhausted at the time when we were told that the capitulation had been signed and we were to cease firing.
You said that some of the civilians were hostile. Yes. Did you personally see any evidence of that?
I certainly did.
Can you tell me?
I can tell you one. Well, yes, they were all indicating to the Japs as they came, the fighters came over by flashing lights in various. In fact, in one window in the Raffles Hotel, just opposite our gun site, there was a light going on and off, on and off, on and off, and we, a few of us, went into the hotel, and we did sift out one Chinese who was signalling the enemy. Well, we assumed he was signalling the enemy. We didn't give him a second chance to signal the enemy.
What did you do?
Killed him. And in the while I was there, I found a dessert spoon with Raffles Hotel on it. I thought that was a good enough souvenir. As it so happens, I was very pleased I did, because when we got out of the building, we found that where any clothing or anything we had, or any little bit of equipment, a building had caught fire, and I started off my captivity with just what I stood up in and one spoon with Raffles Hotel imprinted on it, and I've got that spoon to this very day, and I'm looking forward to easing my conscience when I retire and perhaps return it to the Raffles Hotel.
Did it surprise you that a Chinese should be helping the Japanese, or were all races
helping? I think I should make it very clear in this point. That's a very good point. I do apologize perhaps if I've overemphasized the Chinese. I would say natives or locals, whether they're Chinese, Malays, Tamils, anything under the sun sort of business, the races. But as I say, it was very difficult in the heat of war and what's the name to know chalk from cheese. I could tell somebody who was white colour, but there were a lot of them were these yellow tinted, and also we had a lot of Indian regiments out there as well, which, I mean, one can always tell the Indian regiments and the Gurkhas we had out there. So there were many, many different nationalities in the thing, but a lot of them were, some were Malays, some were Chinese, some were, in fact, no doubt, some of them were perhaps wayward Thais or Siamese that had been come over the border.
So you weren't sure which race this particular chap
was? No, that's why I'm making that perfectly clear. I must make that in all fairness.
So what happened to you next?
Next, it was night. And what a wonderful night's sleep we had. That was the first night's sleep, good sleep I'd had since the commencement of the fighting, which I suppose in December, through to February the 15th. And that was a very good night's sleep. Then we found that we were all ordered to various rendezvous points, and there were Japanese wandering around looking for watches, particularly Omega watches for some unknown reason, and Parker fountain pens, and stealing what they could from us, etc. And then we were concentrated in this one area on Singapore Island, and we had to march then out to Changi Point, which was turned into a vast prisoner of war camp. There, in this area, we were guarded, of course, by the Japanese, and they had formed with some of the Indian regiments, they had formed they called it the INA, the Indian National Army, under a chap called Shandal Bose, who was a traitor. He formed this army, and some of their troops were even guarding us. Our own Indian troops were guarding us. And we did come across those Indians later when we were up in Siam on manning AK-AK gun sites, firing against their own people.
How did they behave, the Indians who were in charge of you?
Like a lot of bastards. They were very anti. Let me say, they had been indoctrinated. A lot of them had been indoctrinated. They were weak, and they'd been indoctrinated, and it wasn't a very good situation.
In what way was their treatment bad?
What way was it? Well, they didn't mind using their fists and their rifles and things for making themselves objectionable.
So what happened next to you?
Next, we spent a period in Changi, in various places. They did move our... they moved the 11th Indian Division artillery all into one area, Berber Camp, and I spent a part of the time in Changi prison itself. The funny part about it was we were in that area, but if we wanted to go to the toilet, we had to go through the main doors because the sanitation wasn't working in the prison and do it in the trench outside, which is quite an amusing sort of little episode. But we didn't get a cell to ourselves, and then we were moved out of there after a while because the civilian internees were moved into the prison, and that's where they spent their period of captivity.